Expect she's dead by now, somewhere in the mountains of the moon. If that is true, slit my throat and have done with it. He was dizzy from the wine, tired and heartsick. Your blood is the last thing I desire. Ned frowned. When they slaughtered my guard, you stood beside the queen and watched and said not a word. And what again? I seem to recall that I was unarmed, unarmored, and surrounded by Lannister swords. The eunuch looked at him curiously, tilting his head. When I was a young boy, before I was cut, I travelled with a troop of mummers through the free cities. They taught me that each man has a role to play in life as well as mummery. So it is at court. The king's justice must be fearsome. The master of coin must be frugal. The lord commander of the king's guard must be valiant. And the master of whisperers must be sly and obsequious and without scruple. A courageous informer would be as useless as a cowardly knight. He took the wineskin back and drank. Ned studied the eunuch's face, searching for truth beneath the mummer's scars and false stubble. He tried some more wine. This time it went down easier. Can you free me from this pit?
I could, but will I? No. Questions would be asked, and the answers would lead back to me.
Ned had expected no more. You are blunt.
A eunuch has no honour, and a spider does not enjoy the luxury of scruples, my lord.
Would you at least consent to carry a message out for me?
That would depend on the message. I will gladly provide you with paper and ink, if you like, and when you have written what you will, I will take the letter and read it, and deliver it or not, as best serves my own ends.
Your own ends? What ends are those, Lord Varys?
Peace, Varys replied without hesitation. If there was one soul in King's Landing who was truly desperate to keep Robert Baratheon alive, it was me, he sighed. For 15 years I protected him from his enemies, but I could not protect him from his friends. What strange fit of madness led you to tell the queen that you had learned the truth of Joffrey's birth?
The madness of mercy, Ned admitted.
Ah, said Varys, to be sure. You are an honest and honourable man, Lord Eddard. Oft-times I forget that. I have met so few of them in my life.
He glanced around the cell.
When I see what honesty and honour have won you, I understand why.
Ned Stark laid his head back against the damp stone wall and closed his eyes. His leg was throbbing. The king's wine. Did you question Lancel?
Oh, indeed. Cersei gave him the wineskins and told him it was Robert's favourite vintage.
The eunuch shrugged.
A hunter lives a perilous life. If the boar had not done for Robert, it would have been a fall from a horse, the bite of a wood adder, an arrow gone astray. The forest is the abattoir of the gods. It was not wine that killed the king. It was your mercy.
Ned had feared as much. Gods forgive me.
If there are gods, Varys said, I expect they will. The queen would not have waited long in any case. Robert was becoming unruly, and she needed to be rid of him to free her hands to deal with his brothers. They're quite a pair, Stannis and Renly. The iron gauntlet and the silk glove.
He wiped his mouth with the back of his hand.
You have been foolish, my lord.
You ought to have heeded Littlefinger when he urged you to support Joffrey's succession. How could you know that?
Varys smiled.
I know. That's all that need concern you. I also know that on the morrow the Queen will pay your visit.
Slowly Ned raised his eyes.
Why? Cersei is frightened of you, my lord. But she has other enemies she fears even more. Her beloved Jaime is fighting the River Lords even now. Lysa Aaron sits in the Eyrie, ringed in stone and steel, and there is no love lost between her and the Queen. In Dorne, the Martells still brood on the murder of Princess Ilya and her babes. And now your son marches down the Nick with a northern host at his back.
Rob is only a boy, Ned said aghast.
A boy with an army, Varys said. Yet only a boy, as you say. The king's brothers are the ones giving Cersei sleepless nights. Lord Stannis in particular. His claim is a true one. He is known for his prowess as a battle commander, and he is utterly without mercy. There is no creature on earth half so terrifying as a truly just man. No one knows what Stannis has been doing on Dragonstone, but I will wager you that he has gathered more swords than seashells. So here is Cersei's nightmare. While her father and brother spend their power battling Starks and Tullys, Lord Stannis will land, proclaim himself king, and lop off her son's curly blonde head. And her own in the bargain, though I truly believe she cares more about the boy.
Stannis Baratheon is Robert's true heir, Ned said. The throne is his by rights. I would welcome his assent. Varys tisked.
Cersei would not want to hear that, I promise you. Stannis may win the throne, but only your rotting head will remain to cheer unless you guard that tongue of yours. Sansa begged so sweetly, it would be a shame if you threw it all away. You are being given your life back, if you'll take it. Cersei is no fool. She knows a tame wolf is more use than a dead one.
You want me to serve the woman who murdered my king, butchered my men, and crippled my son? Ned's voice was thick with disbelief.
I want you to serve the realm, Varys said. Tell the queen that you will confess your vile treason, command your son to lay down his sword, and proclaim Joffrey as the true heir. Offer to denounce Stannis and Renly as faithless usurpers. Our green-eyed lioness knows you are a man of honour. If you will give her the peace she needs and the time to deal with Stannis, and pledge to carry her secret to your grave, I believe she will allow you to take the black and live out the rest of your days on the wall with your brother and that base-born son of yours.
The thought of John filled Ned with a sense of shame and a sorrow too deep for words. If only he could see the boy again, sit and talk with him. Pain shut through his broken leg, beneath the filthy grey plaster of his cast. He winced, his fingers opening and closing helplessly. "Is this your own scheme?" he gasped out at Varys. "Or are you in league with Littlefinger?" That seemed to amuse the eunuch.
"I would sooner wed the black goat of Cahor. Littlefinger is the second most devious man in the Seven Kingdoms. Oh, I feed him choice whispers, sufficient so that he thinks I am his, just as I allow Cersei to believe that I am hers.
And just as you let me believe that you are mine." Tell me, Lord Varus, who do you truly serve? Varus smiled thinly.
Why, the realm, my good lord. However could you doubt that? I swear it by my lost manhood. I serve the realm, and the realm needs peace.
He finished the last swallow of wine and tossed the empty skin aside.
So what is your answer, Lord Eddard? Give me your word that you'll tell the Queen what she wants to hear when she comes calling.
If I did, my word would be as hollow as an empty suit of armour. My life is not so precious to me as that.
Pity, the eunuch stood. And your daughter's life, my lord, how precious is that?
A chill pierced Ned's heart.
My daughter? Well, surely you did not think I'd forgotten about your sweet innocent, my lord. The Queen most certainly has not.
No, Ned pleaded, his voice cracking. Varys, God have mercy, do as you like with me, but leave my daughter out of your schemes. Sansa's no more than a child.
Rhaenys was a child too, Prince Rhaegar's daughter, a precious little thing, younger than your girls. She had a small black kitten she called Balerion. Do you know? I always wondered what happened to him. Rhaenys liked to pretend he was the true Balerion, the black dread of old, but I imagine the Lannisters taught her the difference between a kitten and a dragon quick enough the day they broke down her door.
Varys gave a long, weary sigh, the sigh of a man who carried all the sadness of the world in a sack upon his shoulders.
The High Septon once told me that as we sin, so do we suffer. If that's true, Lord Eddard, tell me. Why is it always the innocents who suffer most when you High Lords play your Game of Thrones? Ponder it, if you would, while you wait upon the Queen, and spare a thought for this as well. The next visitor who calls on you could bring you bread and cheese and the milk of the poppy for your pain. Or he could bring you Sansa's head. The choice, my dear Lord Hend, is entirely yours.
John. That night he dreamt of wildlings howling from the woods, advancing to the moan of war horns and the roll of drums. Boom, 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 came the sound, a thousand hearts with a single beat. Some had spears, and some had bows, and some had axes. Others rode on chariots made of bones, drawn by teams of dogs as big as ponies. Giants lumbered amongst them, 40 feet tall, with mauls the size of oak trees. "Stand fast," Jon Snow called. "Throw them back." He stood atop the wall alone. "Flame," he cried. "Feed them flame." But there was no one to pay heed. "They are all gone. They have abandoned me." Burning shafts hissed upward, trailing tongues of fire. Scarecrow brothers tumbled down, black cloaks ablaze. "Snow!" an eagle cried, as foemen scuttled up the ice like spiders. John was armoured in black ice, but his blade burned red in his fist. As the dead men reached the top of the wall, he sent them down to die again. He slew a greybeard and a beardless boy, a giant, a gaunt man with file teeth, a girl with thick red hair. Too late, he recognized Ygritte. She was gone as quick as she'd appeared. The world dissolved into a red mist. John stabbed and slashed and cut. He hacked down Donal Noy and gutted Deaf Dick Thollard. Corran Halfhand stumbled to his knees, trying in vain to staunch the flow of blood from his neck. "I am the Lord of Winterfell," John screamed. It was Rob before him now, his hair wet with melting snow. Longclaw took his head off. Then a gnarled hand seized John roughly by the shoulder. He whirled and woke, with a raven pecking at his chest.
"Snow!"
the bird cried. John swatted at it. The raven shrieked its displeasure and flapped up to a bedpost to glare down balefully at him through the pre-dawn gloom. The day had come. It was the hour of the wolf. Soon enough the sun would rise, and 4,000 wildlings would come pouring through the wall. Madness! Jon Snow ran his burned hand through his hair and wondered once again what he was doing. Once the gate was opened, there would be no turning back. It should have been the old bear to treat with Tormund. It should have been Jeremy Riker, or Corran Halfhand, or Dennis Mellister, or some other seasoned man. It should have been my uncle. It was too late for such misgivings, though. Every choice had its risks, every choice its consequences. He would play the game to its conclusion. He rose and dressed in darkness, as Mormont's raven muttered across the room.
"Corn,"
the bird said,
"and king,
and
snow, Jon Snow, Jon Snow."
That was queer. The bird had never said his full name before, as best John could recall. He broke his fast in the cellar with his officers. Fried bread, fried eggs, blood sausages, and barley porridge made up the meal, washed down with thin yellow beer. As they ate, they went over the preparations yet again.
"All is in readiness," Bowen Marsh assured him. "If the wildlings uphold the terms of the bargain, all will go as you've commanded.
And if not, it may turn to blood and carnage." "Remember," John said, "Tormund's people are hungry, cold, and fearful. Some of them hate us as much as some of you hate them. We are dancing on rotten ice here, them and us. One crack, and we all drown. If blood should be shed today, it had best not be one of us who strikes the first blow, or I swear by the old gods and the new that I will have the head of the man who strikes it." They answered him with eyes and nods and muttered words, with "as you command," and "it will be done," and "yes, my lord." And one by one they rose and buckled on their swords and donned their warm black cloaks and strode out into the cold. Last to leave the table was Dolorous Ed Tollett, who had come in during the night with 6 wagons from the Long Barrow. Horse Barrow, the Black Brothers call the fortress now. Ed had been sent to gather up as many spear wives as his wagons would hold, and bring them back to join their sisters. John watched him mop up a runny yolk with a chunk of bread. It was strangely comforting to see Ed's dour face again. "How goes the restoration work?" he asked his old steward.
10 more years should do it," Tollett replied, in his usual gloomy tone. "Place was overrun with rats when we moved in. The spearwives killed the nasty buggers. Now the place is overrun with spearwives. These days I want the rats back."
"How do you find serving under Iron Emmett?" John asked.
"Mostly it's Black Maris serving under him, my lord. Me, I have the mules. Nettles claims we're kin. It's true we have the same long face, but I'm not near as stubborn. Anyway, I never knew their mothers, on my honour."
He finished the last of his eggs and sighed.
I do like me a nice runny egg. If it please me, lord, don't let the wildlings eat all our chickens."
Out in the yard, the eastern sky had just begun to lighten. There was not a wisp of cloud in sight. "We have a good day for this, it would seem," John said. "A bright day, warm and sunny."
"The wall will weep, and winter almost on us. It's unnatural, my lord. A bad sign, you ask me."
John smiled. "And if it were to snow?"
"A worse sign."
"What sort of weather would you prefer?"
The sort they keep indoors," said Dolorous Ed. "If it please, my lord,
I should get back to my mules. They miss me when I'm gone, more than I can say for them spear wives. They parted there, Tullet for the east road, where his wagons waited, John Snow for the stables. Saturn had his horse saddled and bridled and waiting for him, a fiery grey courser with a mane as black and shiny as maester's ink. He was not the sort of mount that John would have chosen for arranging, but on this morning all that mattered was that he look impressive, and for that the stallion was a perfect choice. His tail was waiting too. John had never liked surrounding himself with guards, but today it seemed prudent to keep a few good men beside him. They made a grim display in their ringmail, iron half-helms, and black cloaks, with tall spears in their hands and swords and daggers on their belts. For this John had passed over all the green boys and greybeards in his command, choosing 8 men in their prime: Ty and Molly, Left-Hand Lou, Big Liddle, Rory, Fulk the Flea, Garrett Greenspear, and Leathers, Castle Black's new master-at-arms, to show the free folk that even a man who had fought for Mance in the battle beneath the wall could find a place of honour in the night's watch. A deep red blush had appeared in the east by the time they had all assembled at the gate. "The stars are going out," John thought. When next they reappeared, they would be shining down upon a world forever changed. A few Queen's men stood watching from beside the embers of Lady Melisandre's nightfire. When John glanced at the King's Tower, he glimpsed a flash of red behind a window. Of Queen Selyse he saw no sign. It was time. "Open the gate," John Snow said softly.
"Open the gate!"
Big Liddle roared. His voice was thunder. 700 feet above, the sentries heard and raised their war horns to their lips. The sound rang out, echoing off the wall and out across the world.
"Oh!"
One long blast. For 1,000 years or more, that sound had meant rangers coming home. Today it meant something else. Today it called the free folk to their new homes. On either end of the long tunnel, gates swung open and iron bars unlocked. Dawn light shimmered on the ice above, pink and gold and purple. Dolores Ed had not been wrong. The wall would soon be weeping. God grant it weeps alone. Saturn led them underneath the ice, lighting the way through the gloom of the tunnel with an iron lantern. John followed, leading his horse. Then the guardsmen. After them came Bowen Marsh and his stewards, a score of them, every man assigned a task. Above, Ulmer of the Kingswood had the wall. 20 of Castle Black's best bowmen stood with him, ready to respond to any trouble down below with a rain of arrows. North of the wall, Tormund Giantsbane was waiting, mounted on a runty little garron that looked far too weedy to support his weight. His 2 remaining sons were with him, tall Torrig and young Drin, along with 30 warriors.
"Ah!" Tormund called. "Guards, is it? Now, where's the trust in that crow?"
"You brought more men than I did."
"So I did. Come here by me, lad. I want my folk to see you. I got thousands ne'er saw a Lord Commander, grown men who were told as boys that your rangers would eat them if they didn't behave. They need to see you plain, a long-faced lad in an old black cloak. They need to learn that the night's watch is not to be feared."
"That is a lesson I would sooner they never learned." John peeled the glove off his burned hand, put 2 fingers in his mouth, and whistled. Ghosts came racing from the gate. Tormund's horse shied so hard that the wildling almost lost his saddle. "Naught to be feared," John said. "Ghost, stay."
"You are a black-hearted bastard, Lord Crow."
Tormund Hornblower lifted his own war horn to his lips. The sound of it echoed off the ice like rolling thunder, and the first of the free folk began to stream toward the gate. From dawn till dusk, John watched the wildlings pass. The hostages went first, 100 boys between the ages of 8 and 16. "Your blood price, Lord Crow," Tormund declared. "I hope the wailing of their poor mothers don't haunt your dreams at night." Some of the boys were led to the gate by a mother or a father, others by older siblings. More came alone. 14- and 15-year-old boys were almost men and did not want to be seen clinging to a woman's skirts. Two stewards counted the boys as they went by, noting each name on long sheepskin scrolls. A third collected their valuables for the toll and wrote that down as well. The boys were going to a place that none had ever been before, to serve an order that had been the enemy of their kith and kin for thousands of years. Yet John saw no tears, heard no wailing mothers. "These are winter's people," he reminded himself. "Tears freeze upon your cheeks where they come from." Not a single hostage balked or tried to slink away when his turn came to enter that gloomy tunnel. Almost all the boys were thin, some past the point of gauntness, with spindly shanks and arms like twigs. That was no more than John expected. Elsewise they came in every shape and size and colour. He saw tall boys and short boys, brown-haired boys and black-haired boys, honey blondes and strawberry blondes and redheads kissed by fire, like Ygritte. He saw boys with scars, boys with limps, boys with pockmarked faces. Many of the older boys had downy cheeks or wispy little mustachios, but there was one fellow with a beard as thick as Tormund's. Some dressed in fine soft furs, some in boiled leather and oddments of armour, more in wool and sealskins, a few in rags. One was naked. Many had weapons, sharpened spears, stone-headed mauls, knives made of bone or stone or dragon glass, spiked clubs, tangle nets, even here and there a rust-eaten old sword. The Hornwood boys walked blithe and barefoot through the snowdrifts. Other lads had bear paws on their boots and walked on top of the same drifts, never sinking through the crust. 6 boys arrived on horses, 2 on mules. A pair of brothers turned up with a goat. The biggest hostage was 6.5 feet tall, but had a baby's face. The smallest was a runty boy who claimed 9 years, but looked no more than 6. Of special note were the sons of men of renown. Tormund took care to point them out as they went by. "The boy there is the son of Soren Shieldbreaker," he said of one tall lad. "In with the red hair, he's Gerrit Kingsblood's get. Comes of the line of Raymond Redbeard, to hear him tell it. The line of Redbeard's little brother, you want it true." 2 boys looked enough alike to be twins, but Tormund insisted they were cousins, born a year apart. "One was sired by Harl the Huntsman, t'other by Harl the Handsome, both on the same woman. Fathers ate each other. I was you, I'd send one to Eastwatch and t'other to your shadow tower." Other hostages were named as sons of Hard Wanderer, of Brog, of Devon Sealskinner, Kyleg of the Wooden Ear, Mourner White Mask, the Great Walrus. The Great Walrus, truly? They have queer names along the frozen shore. 3 hostages were sons of Alfin Crowkiller, an infamous raider slain by Corran Halfhand, or so Tormund insisted. They do not look like brothers, John observed. Half-brothers, born of different mothers. Alfin's member was a wee thing, even smaller than yours, but he was never shy with where he stuck it. Had a son in every village, that one. Of a certain runty, red-faced boy, Tormund said, "That one's a whelp, a Varamyr Sixkins. You remember Varamyr, Lord Crow?" He did. The skin changer. "Aye, he was that. A vicious little runt besides. Dead now, like as not. No one's seen him since the battle." 2 of the boys were girls in disguise. When John saw them, he dispatched Rory and Big Liddle to bring them to him. One came meekly enough, the other kicking and biting. This could end badly. "Do these two have famous fathers?"
"Ha! Them skinny things, not likely. Picked by lot."
"They're girls."
"Are they?"
Tormund squinted at the pair of them from his saddle.
"Me and Lord Crow made a wager on which of you as the biggest member. Pull them breeches down. Give us a look."
One of the girls turned red. The other glared defiantly.
"You leave us alone, Tormund giant stink. You let us go."
"Ah, you win, Crow. Not a cock between them. The little one's got a set of balls, though. A spear wife in the making, eh?"
He called to his own men.
"Go find them something girly to put on before Lord Snow wets his small clothes."
"I'll need two boys to take their places."
"How's that?"
Tormund scratched his beard.
"A hostage is a hostage, seems to me. That big sharp sword of yours can snick a girl's head off as easy as a boy's. A father loves his daughters, too. Well, most fathers."
"It is not their fathers who concern me. Did Mance ever sing of brave Danny Flint?"
"Not as I recall. Who was he?"
"A girl who dressed up like a boy to take the black. Her song is sad and pretty. What happened to her wasn't. In some versions of the song, her ghost still walked the night fort. I'll send the girls to Longbarrow." The only men there were Arne Emmett and Dolorous Ed, both of whom he trusted. That was not something he could say of all his brothers. The wildling understood.
"Nasty birds, you crows," he spat. "Two more boys, then. You'll have them."
When 99 hostages had shuffled by them to pass beneath the wall, Tormund Giantsbane produced the last one.
"My son, Drin. You'll see he's well taken care of, Crow, or I'll cook your black liver up and eat it."
John gave the boy a close inspection. Bran's age, or the age it would have been, if Theon had not killed him. Drin had none of Bran's sweetness, though. He was a chunky boy, with short legs, thick arms, and a wide red face, a miniature version of his father, with a shock of dark brown hair. "He'll serve as my own page," John promised Tormund.
"Hear that, Drin? See that you don't get above yourself."
To John he said,
"He'll need a good beating from time to time. Be careful of his teeth, though, he bites."
He reached down for his horn again, raised it, and blew another blast. This time it was warriors who came forward, and not just 100 of them, 500, John Snow judged, as they moved out from beneath the trees, perhaps as many as 1,000. One in every 10 of them came mounted, but all of them came armed. Across their backs they bore round wicker shields covered with hides and boiled leather, displaying painted images of snakes and spiders, severed heads, bloody hammers, broken skulls, and demons. A few were clad in stolen steel, dinted oddments of armor looted from the corpses of fallen rangers. Others had armored themselves in bones, like rattleshirt. All wore fur and leather. There were spear wives with them, long hair streaming. John could not look at them without remembering Ygritte. The gleam of fire in her hair, the look on her face when she disrobed for him in the grotto, the sound of her voice.
"You know nothing, John Snow," she told him 100 times.
It is as true now as it was then. "You might have sent the women first," he said to Tormund, "the mothers and the maids." The wildling gave him a shrewd look.
"Aye, I might have. And you, crows, might decide to close that gate. A few fighters on t'other side, well, that way the gate stays open, don't it?"
He grinned.
"I bought your bloody horse, John Snow. Don't mean that we can't count his teeth. Now don't you go thinking me and mine don't trust you. We trust you just as much as you trust us," he snorted. "You wanted warriors, didn't you? Well, There they are. Every one worth six of your black crows.
John had to smile. So long as they save those weapons for our common foe, I am content.
Gave you my word on it, didn't I? The word of Torment Giant's been strong as iron, tis.
He turned and spat. Amongst the stream of warriors were the fathers of many of John's hostages. Some stared with cold, dead eyes as they went by, fingering their sword hilts. Others smiled at him like long-lost kin, though a few of those smiles discomforted Jon Snow more than any glare. None knelt, but many gave him their oaths.
"What Tormund swore, I swear," declared black-haired Brog, a man of few words.
Sauron's shieldbreaker bowed his head an inch and growled,
"Sauron's axe is yours, Jon Snow, if ever you have need of such."
Red-bearded Garrett Kingsblood brought three daughters.
"They will make fine wives and give their husbands strong sons of royal blood," he boasted, "like their father. They are descended from Raymond Redbeard, who was king beyond the wall."
Blood meant little and less amongst the free folk, John knew. His grit had taught him that. Garrick's daughters shared her same flame-red hair, though hers had been a tangle of curls, and theirs hung long and straight. Kissed by fire. Three princesses, each lovelier than the last, he told their father. "I will see that they are presented to the queen." Selyse Baratheon would take to these three better than she had to Val, he suspected. They were younger and considerably more cowed. Sweet enough to look at them, though their father seems a fool. Hard Wanderer swore his oath upon his sword, as nicked and pitted a piece of iron as John had ever seen. Devin Sealskinner presented him with a sealskin hat, Harl the Huntsman with a bear-claw necklace. The warrior witch, Morna, removed her weirwood mask just long enough to kiss his gloved hand and swear to be his man, or his woman, whichever he preferred. And on and on and on. As they passed, each warrior stripped off his treasures and tossed them into one of the carts that the stewards had placed before the gate. Amber pendants, golden torques, jewel daggers, silver brooches set with gemstones, bracelets, rings, Nyello cups and golden goblets, war horns and drinking horns, a green jade comb, a necklace of freshwater pearls, all yielded up and noted down by Bowen Marsh. One man surrendered a shirt of silver scales that had surely been made for some great lord. Another produced a broken sword with three sapphires in the hilt. And there were queerer things. A toy mammoth made of actual mammoth hair. An ivory phallus. A helm made from a unicorn's head, complete with horn. How much food such things would buy in the free cities, Jon Snow could not begin to say. After the riders came the men of the frozen shore. Jon watched a dozen of their big bone chariots roll past him one by one, clattering like rattle-shirt. Half still rolled as before, others had replaced their wheels with runners. They slid across the snowdrifts, smoothly, where the wheeled chariots were foundering and sinking. The dogs that drew the chariots were fearsome beasts, as big as direwolves. Their women were clad in sealskins, some with infants at their breasts. Older children shuffled along behind their mothers, and looked up at John with eyes as dark and hard as the stones they clutched. Some of the men wore antlers on their hats, and some wore walrus tusks. The two sorts did not love each other, he soon gathered. A few thin reindeer brought up the rear, with the great dogs snapping at the heels of stragglers.
"Be wary of that lot, Jon Snow," Tormund warned him. "A savage folk. The men are bad, the women worse."
He took a skin off his saddle and offered it up to John.
"Here, this will make them seem less fearsome, might be, and warm you for the night. No, go on, it's yours to keep. Drink deep."
Within was a mead so potent It made John's eyes water and sent tendrils of fire snaking through his chest. He drank deep. "You're a good man, Tormund Giants, babe, for a wildling."
"Better than most, might be. Not so good as some."
On and on the wildlings came, as the sun crept across the bright blue sky. Just before midday, the movement stopped when an oxcart became jammed at a turn inside the tunnel. Jon Snow went to have a look for himself. The cart was now wedged solid. The men behind were threatening to hack it apart and butcher the ox where he stood, whilst the driver and his kin swore to kill them if they tried. With the help of Tormund and his son Torreg, John managed to keep the wildlings from coming to blood, but it took the best part of an hour before the way was opened again.
"You need a bigger gate,"
Tormund complained to John, with a sour look up at the sky where a few clouds had blown in.
"Too bloody slow this way, like sucking the milk-water through a reed. Ha! Would that I had the horn of Jorimond. I'd give it a nice toot, and we'd climb through the rubble."
Melisandre burned the horn of Jorimond.
"Did she?" Tormund slapped his thigh and hooted. "She burned that fine big horn. Aye, a bloody sin, I call it. 1,000 years old, that was. We found it in a giant's grave, and no man of us had ever seen a horn so big. That must have been why Mance got the notion to tell you it were Jorimond's. He wanted you crows to think he had it in his power to blow your bloody wall down about your knees. But we never found the true horn, not for all our digging. If we had, every kneeler in your 7 kingdoms would have chunks of ice to cool his wine all summer."
John turned in his saddle, frowning. And Jorimond blew the horn of winter and woke giants from the earth. That huge horn, with its bands of old gold, incised with ancient runes. Had Mance Rayder lied to him? Or was Tormund lying now? If Mance's horn was just a feint, where is the true horn? By afternoon the sun had gone, and the day turned grey and gusty.
"A snow sky," Tormund announced grimly.
Others had seen the same omen in those flat white clouds. It seemed to spur them on to haste. Tempers began to fray. One man was stabbed when he tried to slip in ahead of others who had been hours in the column. Torreg wrenched the knife away from his attacker, dragged both men from the press, and sent them back to the wildling camp to start again. "Tormund," John said, as they watched 4 old women pull a cart full of children toward the gate, "tell me of our foe. I would know all there is to know of the others." The wildling rubbed his mouth.
"Not here," he mumbled. "Not this side of your wall."
The old man glanced uneasily toward the trees in their white mantles.
"They're never far, you know. They won't come out by day. Not when that old sun's shining, but don't think that means they went away. Shadows never go away. Might be you don't see them, but they're always clinging to your heels."
"Did they trouble you on your way south?"
"They never came in force, if that's your meaning. But they were with us, all the same, nibbling at our edges. We lost more outriders than I care to think about, and it was worth your life to fall behind or wander off. Every nightfall, we'd ring our camps with fire. They don't like fire much, and no mistake. When the snows came, though, snow and sleet and freezing rain, it's bloody hard to find dry wood or get your kindling lit. And the cold, oh, some nights our fires just seem to shrivel up and die.
Nights like that, you always find some dead come the morning, lest they find you first. The night that Torwin, my boy, Tormund turned his face away.
"I know," said Jon Snow.
Tormund turned back.
"You know nothing. You killed a dead man, I heard. Mance killed 100. A man can fight the dead, but when their masters come, when the white mists rise up, how do you fight a mist crow
Shadows with teeth, air so cold it hurts to breathe, like a knife inside your chest. You do not know, you cannot know. Can your sword cut cold?
We will see, John thought, remembering the things that Sam had told him, the things he'd found in his old books. Longclaw had been forged in the fires of old Valyria, forged in dragon flame and set with spells. Dragon steel, Sam called it, stronger than any common steel, lighter, harder, sharper. But words in a book were one thing. The true test came in battle. You are not wrong, John said. I do not know. And if the guards are good, I never will.
The guards are seldom good, John Snow.
Tormund nodded towards the sky.
The clouds roll in. Already it grows darker, colder. Your wall no longer weeps, look.
He turned and called out to his son, Torric.
Ride back to the camp and get them moving. The sick ones and the weak ones, the slugger beds and cravens, get them on their bloody feet. Set their bloody tents afire, if you must. The gate must close at nightfall. Any man not through the wall by then, at best pray the others get to him afore I do. You hear?
I hear.
Torric put his heels into his horse and galloped back down the column. On and on the wildlings came. The day grew darker, just as Tormund said. Clouds covered the sky from horizon to horizon, and warmth fled. There was more shoving at the gate, as men and goats and bullocks jostled each other out of the way. It is more than impatience, John realized. They are afraid. Warriors, spearwives, raiders, they are frightened of those woods, of shadows moving through the trees. They want to put the wall between them before the night descends. A snowflake danced upon the air, then another. Dance with me, John Snow, he thought. You'll dance with me anon. On and on and on the wildlings came. Some were moving faster now, hastening across the battleground. Others, the old, the young, the feeble, could scarce move at all. This morning the field had been covered with a thick blanket of old snow, its white crust shining in the sun. Now the field was brown and black and slimy. The passage of the free folk had turned the ground to mud and muck. Wooden wheels and horses' hooves, runners of bone and horn and iron, pig trotters, heavy boots, the cloven feet of cows and bullocks, the bare black feet of the hornwood folk, all had left their marks. The soft footing slowed the column even more.
"You need a bigger gate,"
Tormund complained again. By late afternoon the snow was falling steadily, but the river of wildlings had dwindled to a stream. Columns of smoke rose from the trees where their camp had been.
"Torric," Tormund explained, "burn in the dead. Always some will go to sleep and don't wake up. You find them in their tents, them as have tents, curled up and froze. Torric knows what to do."
The stream was no more than a trickle by the time Torric emerged from the wood. With him rode a dozen mounted warriors armed with spears and swords. "My rear guard," Tormund said, with a gap-toothed smile.
"You crows have rangers, so do we. Them I left in camp, in case we were attacked before we all got out.
Your best men,
or my worst. Every man of them has killed a crow."
Amongst the riders came one man afoot, with some big beast trotting at his heels. A boar, John saw, a monstrous boar, twice the size of Ghost. The creature was covered with coarse black hair, with tusks as long as a man's arm. John had never seen a boar so huge or ugly. The man beside him was no beauty either. Hulking, black-browed, he had a flat nose, heavy jowls, dark with stubble, small black close-set eyes.
"Borok!" Tormund turned his head and spat.
A skin changer? It was not a question. Somehow he knew. Ghost turned his head. The falling snow had masked the boar's scent, but now the white wolf had the smell. He padded out in front of John, his teeth bared in a silent snarl.
No, John snapped. Ghost, down! Stay! Stay!
Boars and wolves, said Tormund. Best keep that beast of yours locked up tonight. I'll see that Boric does the same with his pig.
He glanced up at the darkening sky.
Them's the last, and none too soon. It's going to snow all night, I feel it. Time I had a look at what's on t'other side of all that ice.
You go ahead, John told him. I mean to be the last one through the ice. I will join you at the feast.
Feast? Ha ha! Ah, that's a word I like to hear.
The wildling turned his garron toward the wall and slapped her on the rump. Tarig and the riders followed, dismounting by the gate to lead their horses through. Bonemarsh stayed long enough to supervise, as his stewards pulled the last carts into the tunnel. Only Jon Snow and his guards were left. The skin changer stopped 10 yards away. His monster pawed at the mud, snuffling. A light powdering of snow covered the boar's humped black back. He gave a snort and lowered his head. And for half a heartbeat, John thought he was about to charge. To either side of him, his men lowered their spears.
Brother, Boric said,
you'd best go on. We're about to close the gate.
You do that, Boric said. You close it good and tight. They're coming, Crow.
He smiled as ugly a smile as John had ever seen, and made his way to the gate. The boar stalked after him. The falling snow covered up their tracks behind them.
That's done, then, Rory said when they were gone.
No, thought John Snow, it has only just begun. Bonemarsh was waiting for him south of the wall, with a tablet full of numbers.
3,119 wildlings passed through the gate today,
the Lord Steward told him.
60 of your hostages were sent off to East Watch and the Shadow Tower after they'd been fed. Ed Tollett took 6 wagons of women back to Long Barrow. The rest remain with us.
Not for long, John promised him. Tormund means to lead his own folk to Oakenshield within a day or two. The rest will follow, as soon as we sort where to put them.
As you say, Lord Snow.
The words were stiff. The tone suggested that Bonemarsh knew where he would put them. The castle John returned to was far different from the one he'd left that morning. For as long as he had known it, Castle Black had been a place of silence and shadows, where a meagre company of men in black moved like ghosts amongst the ruins of a fortress that had once housed 10 times their numbers. All that had changed. Lights now shone through windows where Jon Snow had never seen light shine before. Strange voices echoed down the yards, and free folk were coming and going along icy paths that had only known the black boots of crows for years. Outside the old flint barracks, he came across a dozen men pelting one another with snow. Playing, John thought in astonishment. Grown men, playing like children, throwing snowballs the way Bran and Arya once did, and Rob and me before them. Donald Noy's old armory was still dark and silent, however, and John's rooms back of the cold forge were darker still. But he had no sooner taken off his cloak than Danil poked his head through the door to announce that Clydus had brought a message.
Send him in.
John lit a taper from an ember in his brazier and 3 candles from the taper. Clydus entered, pink and blinking, the parchment clutched in one soft hand.
I beg pardon, Lord Commander. I know you must be weary, but I thought you would want to see this at once.
You did well. John read. At Hardhome, with 6 ships, wild seas, Blackbird lost with all hands, 2 Lyseni ships driven aground on Skane, Talon taking water, very bad here, wildlings eating their own dead things in the woods, Bravassi captains will only take women, children on their ships. Witch women call us slavers. Attempt to take Storm Crow defeated. 6 crew dead. Many wildlings. 8 ravens left. Dead things in the water. Send help by land. Seas racked by storms. From Talon, by hand of Maester Harmoon. Cutter Pike had made his angry mark below.
"Is it grievous, my lord?"
asked Clydes. "Grievous enough. Dead things in the wood. Dead things in the water. 6 ships left of the 11 that set sail." Jon Snow rolled up the parchment, frowning. "Night falls," he thought. "And now my war begins."
Tyrion. Tyrion dressed himself in darkness, listening to his wife's soft breathing from the bed they shared. "She dreams," he thought, when Sansa murmured something softly, a name perhaps, though it was too faint to say, and turned onto her side. As man and wife, they shared a marriage bed, but that was all. Even her tears she hoards to herself. He had expected anguish and anger when he told her of her brother's death, but Sansa's face had remained so still that for a moment he feared she had not understood. It was only later, with a heavy oaken door between them, that he heard her sobbing. Tyrion had considered going to her then, to offer what comfort he could. "No," he had to remind himself, "she will not look for solace from a Lannister." The most he could do was to shield her from the uglier details of the Red Wedding as they came down from the Twins. Sansa did not need to hear how her brother's body had been hacked and mutilated, he decided, nor how her mother's corpse had been dumped naked into the Green Fork in a savage mockery of House Tully's funeral customs. The last thing the girl needed was more fodder for her nightmares. It was not enough, though. He had wrapped his cloak around her shoulders and sworn to protect her, but that was as cruel a jape as the crown the Freys had placed atop the head of Robb Stark's direwolf after they'd sewn it onto his headless corpse. Sansa knew that as well, the way she looked at him, her stiffness, when she climbed into their bed. When he was with her, never for an instant could he forget who he was or what he was. No more than she did. She still went nightly to the God's Wood to pray, and Tyrion wondered if she were praying for his death. She had lost her home, her place in the world, and everyone she had ever loved or trusted. "Winter is coming," warned the Stark words, and truly it had come for them with a vengeance. "But it is high summer for House Lannister, so why am I so bloody cold?" He pulled on his boots, fastened his cloak with a lion's head brooch, and slipped out into the torchlit hall. There was this much to be said for his marriage. It had allowed him to escape Maegor's Holdfast. Now that he had a wife and household, his lord father had agreed that more suitable accommodations were required, and Lord Giles had found himself abruptly dispossessed of his spacious apartments atop the kitchen keep. And splendid apartments they were, too, with a large bedchamber, an adequate solar, a bath and dressing room for his wife, and small adjoining chambers for Pod and Sansa's maids. Even Bronn's cell by the stair had a window of sorts. "Well, more an arrow slit, but it lets in light." The castle's main kitchen was just across the courtyard, true, but Tyrion found those sounds and smells infinitely preferable to sharing Maegor's with his sister. The less he had to see of Cersei, the happier he was like to be. Tyrion could hear Brella snoring as he passed her cell. Shay complained of that, but it seemed a small enough price to pay. Varys had suggested the woman to him. In former days she had run Lord Renly's household in the city, which had given her a deal of practice at being blind, deaf, and mute. Lighting a taper, he made his way back to the servant's steps
and descended. The floors below his own were still, and he heard no footsteps but his own. Down he went, to the ground floor and beyond,